Got some minutes from March 6th. Everybody read them till Representative Lewis?
I would move those minutes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wright, and any discussion about that? Not all in favor of adopting the minutes from March 6, 19, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye opposed? Okay. Representative Becker Finn.
Aye.
Your House File 0359.
Yep. So, Mr. Chair, I would move House File 359 to be referred to Ways and Means. And then I do have an amendment, if you want to take care of that first.
Very good. Please proceed
So, Mr. Chair, I would move the A19-0169 amendment. What this amendment would do is in previous committee stops, it was brought up that there were some concerns by St. Paul Park for the refinery and just a concern about the type of firefighting foam that would be available in an actual emergency. And so what we've done we've basically made an exception for oil refineries, oil and petroleum terminals, and airports. It would still require that they use the safer Class B or a Class A firefighting foam for training exercises, so we'd still be limiting the exposure to the chemicals, but they still would have the options if they needed them in an actual emergency.
Okay. Any discussion on the A19-0169 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye opposed? The amendment is adopted and the bill's the way you want it?
Yep.
Please proceed.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 359 would ban the use of certain types of flame retardant chemicals in both children's products and in furniture. And the thinking behind this is that, one, these chemicals are not, don't actually provide the benefit that they were initially advocated for, and we're in a situation now where these chemicals, when burned, are essentially poisoning our firefighters when they are have to be in the smoke from those chemicals. So I do have a couple testifiers who will speak to the bill, and then I'm happy to take questions after that.
Good. Please proceed and give
us
your name and
your
testimony.
Yep. Good evening. I'm Jenna Grove. I'm here to speak in support of the bill on behalf of Clean Water Action. I realize that most of you here have probably heard the testimony on this issue, so I'll keep it brief for sake of time and start by reiterating our appreciation of Representative Becker Finn for bringing this bill forward so Minnesota can continue to address the widespread and unnecessary use of toxic flame retardant chemicals in consumer products. I'd like to first acknowledge that not all chemicals are unnecessary, and similarly, not all chemicals pose a threat to human health, but the scientific consensus on the class of chemicals up for consideration today is in. So with that said, manufacturers began adding these to consumer products to comply with a flammability standard established by the state of California in 1975. In 2013, that standard was changed, and in 2018, California, the very state that established the requirement, enacted the broadest prohibitions yet. So despite no longer being required by state regulators and the insurmountable scientific evidence that flame retardants are both ineffective and harmful to human health, are still being routinely added to consumer products every day. The industry representatives state they support waiting for federal action. And as I've stated before, we also support strong federal chemical policy reform, but we do not support states in action until that happens. It took our federal government almost 40 years to modernize the Toxic Substances Control Act. And in that reform, they did set new guidelines for regulating chemicals, but it does not specifically call out any flame retardants. And while the CPSC, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, did grant a petition on a subset of flame retardant chemicals, to this date they have only issued a voluntary directive for consumers and businesses on how to avoid organohalogenated flame retardants. With that said, I think that this takes Minnesota a step in the right direction toward protecting the health of firefighters and especially children, and I hope that you will support this bill.
I do have another testifier, Jeremiah Melquist from the Minnesota Professional Fire Captain Melquist.
Very good. You're
not going to
give us your name and give
testimony. Jeremiah Melquist. Good evening, good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me to testify here before you today. My name is Jeremiah Melquist. Like I said, I'm a Central District Trustee for the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, an association representing nearly 2,000 career firefighters, paramedics, and dispatchers in dozens of communities throughout the state. I'm here today to convey the Minnesota Professional Firefighters' support of HF 359. You may be asking yourself, why would firefighters be against the use of flame retardants? The reason is that flame retardants used in furniture are ineffective in slowing fire spread, and they are dangerously toxic to the public and acutely toxic to firefighters when they are burned and vaporized into the air. Despite being healthier than the general public on average, firefighters have a 14% greater chance of dying from cancer. This is according to a study published in 2013 by the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health of 30,000 career firefighters over a span of 50 years. Other studies have confirmed that firefighters are acutely exposed to dangerous furans and dioxins, which are the toxic combustion byproducts of flame retardants. In the course of our work, and continue to be exposed well after when the fire is out, contaminating our protective gear, our fire apparatus, and even our living quarters back in the stations. Blood draws done on firefighters after building fires have revealed that firefighters have 100 times the level of furans and dioxins in their blood compared to the average adult. Flame retardants are woefully ineffective in stopping fire spread. A study published in 2000 in the Journal of Fire Science concluded that fires involving furniture treated with flame retardants only provided 3 extra seconds of escape time. At the same time, they're producing twice the amount of smoke, 7 times the amount of carbon monoxide, and 80 times the amount of soot compared to a non-treated furniture. This result actually contributes to deteriorating conditions and inhibits fire escapability due to lack of visibility and breathable air. All this begs the question, why continue to use them? Turning to the issue of Class B firefighting foam, the military, the FAA, airport fire departments, including our own MSP and even Congress last fall, have recognized the dangers associated with the use of firefighting foam containing PFCs. The Metropolitan Airports Commission goes to great lengths to mitigate the exposure of firefighters and the public to Class B firefighting foam via the use of expensive containment systems. That said, emergencies do occur everywhere, requiring the use of Class B foam, which will disperse PFCs into the environment and will contaminate firefighters, the environment, and our water supply. Minnesota needs to do what it can to limit the exposure of firefighters to PFC-added Class B foam by limiting its sale to certain industries and ending its use in firefighting training exercises. Again, thank you for your time and allowing me to testify before you today.
Okay, do we have any other testifiers? Yes, sir. State your name and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's David Wallinga. I'm a University of Minnesota-trained physician, and I'm speaking in support of the bill and on behalf of the Natural Resources Defense Council, where I'm senior health officer. So flame retardants are a class of hundreds of different chemicals that you've heard the science now links to a slew of health problems. That's mainly what I'm here to speak to today, in addition to how people get exposed to these chemicals. They're in a slew of different consumer products. You can't see them, so what is it that makes flame retardants dangerous to us? It's in part their chemical properties. They're not bound to other compounds in these products. They can volatilize, and that means they go throughout the home. They can also migrate into dust. So obviously we heard that firefighters breathe these flame retardants when they're doing their job, in addition to other things like dioxins and furans. But little kids too have high exposures, because little kids are on top of the furniture, they're crawling around in the dust, they're sticking their toys in their mouth, they're sticking their fingers in their mouth. And so all of us in this room virtually have traces of flame retardant chemicals in our bodies and our urine, but little kids have higher concentrations, and firefighters have up to hundreds of times higher concentrations. Firefighters, as we heard, support HF 359 because they are already suffering higher rates of the health effects that these chemicals have been linked to, but also because they're not effective and don't really provide any fire safety benefit. They're just not needed. And yet Minnesota still allows them in the products that the bill covers. Several states no longer do. They don't allow them in furniture because they provide no fire safety benefit in furniture. California also bans them from mattress foams, and children's products that are covered under this bill. In fact, testing of the kinds of products in the bill generally shows that the majority of manufacturers are no longer using these flame retardant chemicals, even outside those states. It's their continued use in a minority of products that is resulting in states, including Minnesota, that is resulting in us continuing to be exposed to them. Just a couple more points. So, of course, like many poisons, many flame retardants tend to have more health effects at higher concentrations, higher exposures, and these include things like cancers, disturbances in immune function, hormone function, defects in children's learning and development, and also infertility, problems getting pregnant. These are just a few of the many health conditions that exposure to these chemicals has been tied to. So, for a long time, the most used of these flame retardants were polybrominated diphenyl ethers, PBDEs. Those are the most studied ones. Those are the ones where we have the strongest data. But what's happened over time is many of those have been phased out and replaced with other flame retardant chemicals with many of these same properties. They're persistent. They bioaccumulate in our tissues and our bodies. And the more we study these replacements, we're finding the same sorts of health problems that we found with PBDEs. So in short, there's no fire safety benefit in the products covered under the bill to including this class of potentially dangerous chemicals. And so there's no reason for Minnesota law not to eliminate their use in those products. It's been proposed that Minnesota should wait for action by the federal government, which may never come. It's been decades since they've been on the market, and so I don't think it's really fair to ask Minnesotans to wait for protections for their health, for firefighters to wait for protections for their job, rather than act now to eliminate the use of a chemical that provides no benefit. So thank you. HF 359 will do exactly that, and so we urge your support for the bill with your votes. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, now we're going to wait until we've had all the testifiers, but if that's okay, hopefully nobody will take off on us here. Then we'll have questions from members. Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any other testimonies, but I don't know if there's anyone from the public.
Any other folks in the audience? Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's a long day and going to be a long week, so I will be brief with my comments. I keep Representative Beckerfin and I keep teasing each other what day of the week it is. So it's Tuesday.
I think it's Tuesday.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis, and I'm representing the American Chemistry Council as I sit before you this evening. I just wanted to touch on a couple of brief points that flame retardants do play an important role in fire safety. Once a fire reaches what's known as a critical flashover stage, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to slow the structure of the fire. So flame retardants' value in helping prevent this flashover from occurring. It prevents fires from starting, it slows the spread of initial fires, and reduces the intensity of the fires. We've talked a little bit this evening about what's going on at the federal level, and I'd like to just highlight a couple of things. In 2015, multiple parties petitioned the Consumer Product Safety Commission for a rulemaking on consumer products containing flame retardants. In September 2017, the Consumer Product Safety Commission granted that petition and directed staff to convene a chronic hazard advisory panel. Mr. Chairman, that chronic hazard advisory panel is also working with the National Academy of Sciences to develop a plan to assess health risks of identified flame retardants. I'd also like to quote Ellen Mantis, who is the staff officer from the Consumer Product Safety Commission, that she anticipates that the committee is expected to finalize its advice on flame retardants to the Consumer Product Safety Commission in the first half of 2019. So we're anticipating a report coming out from the Consumer Product Safety Commission in regards to that. One final point on the Consumer Product Safety Commission, Mr. Chairman, they are also working on a national flammability standard for upholstered furniture. I want to point out a couple of safety standards that are in place currently right now. The Consumer Product Safety Commission has the authority to ban regulation of toys and children's products that it believes to be hazardous. The Consumer Product Safety Commission also administers two flammability standards for mattresses. It was referenced by Ms. Grove. Toxic Substances Control Act requires the EPA to make safety determinations for any new and existing chemicals, including flame retardants. Mr. Chairman, I want to thank Representative Beckerfin for the amendment, too. It clarifies some of the firefighting foam. It's valuable in controlling combustible and flammable liquid fires, so that foam helps rapidly extinguish those fires. So we also, as an industry, encourage and minimizing its use in testing and treating, which the amendment does address, Mr. Chairman. But current alternatives do not meet military specifications for extinguishing fires, and we're concerned that it may require costly equipment changes. And one final point, Mr. Chairman, is when we talk about, I've been working on this issue for a number of years, and when we talk about, and I've worked with the advocates on this, when we used to talk about chemicals and flame retardants, there was usually a list of 10 to 15 in certain applications, children's products or furniture. When we talk about classes of products now, we're talking about hundreds of chemicals, and we expand the definition of that. So we're concerned about unintended consequences of what we may or may not ban here in Minnesota with that going on. With that, Mr. Chairman, I've had some great conversations with some of the advocates of it. Representative Beckerfin has probably seen more of me than she wants to see in the last couple of days. So we will keep having these conversations as we move forward, Mr. Chairman, and thank you very much for the time today to testify.
We have another testifier, looks like, so come on up. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the committee. Excuse me, my name is Bruce Newstead. I work for the members of the Minnesota Retailers Association. We appreciate the opportunity to testify on House File 359 today. As you all know, product safety is paramount to retailers, and as such, we've been working with suppliers and manufacturers over the years to sell products that are safe and effective. Safety standards today are generally driven by federal law and federal standards, both voluntary and mandatory. And I think you've heard a little bit about the Consumer Product Safety Commission work. I wanted to point out that in 2016, Congress passed and President Obama signed an updated federal Toxic Substances Control Act. That act put in place a mechanism to develop one national standard to ensure consumers have access to safe products. The scientific process is spearheaded by the Environmental Protection Agency. This overall system of federal standards when it comes to chemicals and consumer safety does provide important clarity to the marketplace and equally as important consistency for consumers. Having this federal standard to satisfy safety requirements is preferred and allows consumers in the U.S. to benefit from safe products. House File 359 does remove, as I've heard, a whole class of flame retardants from use and will have an impact on several consumer products. If this progresses, it's possible many products will be non-compliant or unavailable due to not being able to satisfy the safety requirements. Some of those categories would include children's products such as sleepwear and car seats. Additionally, as you've heard, the sale of mattresses, carpeting, rugs could also be impacted. And with conflicting state and federal requirements of these products, retailers in Minnesota would be forced to discontinue their sale here, and it's unlikely that manufacturers would produce products just for a Minnesota-only standard when it comes to flame retardants. The issue is especially concerning in the area of electronics, where internal and inaccessible components are manufactured specifically to reduce the risk of fire. And it's worth emphasizing again that those components internally are designed to reduce fire in bad situations. In addition to impacting some of the products, we'd see some impact on innovation relative to this market space right now. We're seeing retailers and manufacturers innovate in the safety space, and this would get in the way of that. With these concerns in mind, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we'd ask that we give the Environmental Protection Agency time for their direction on chemicals and a review of flame retardants. It makes sense for Minnesota to allow that process to continue. In addition, we should consider how this bill goes in the direction that other states have not, and again, would have a dramatic impact on internal and inaccessible components. Mr. Chair, I appreciate the work of the author on this bill and the intention behind it, so I hope that we can continue to have a dialogue with a focus on protecting Minnesota's consumers from certain chemicals while meeting important product performance requirements. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any other testifiers in the audience? Okay, seeing none, and I know we have at least one question, and Representative Fabian, I saw your hand first, and do you remember the testifier? You asked him to, or was it for a testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it was the doctor that was up here.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay.
And I apologize, I don't remember your name, doctor.
Yep. Wallinga.
Okay. Dr. Wallinga, in your testimony, you stated, and I wrote it down, that there are several states that have taken this step. Can you tell me those states, please?
I'm going to defer to the Mr. Chair. I would defer to the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maine, Massachusetts, California, and Washington have all passed maybe not exactly the same, but very similar legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so how is this bill language different from the things that have been passed in those other four states?
Mr. Chair, I don't have those exact statutes right in front of me, but the other, at least two of the other states, and I can't remember off the top of my head which two they were, passed this already, and I actually asked House or the Legislative Reference Library to look up to see if there'd been any follow-up news stories or anything, you know, follow-up legislation, if there were any kind of problems or anything like that, and believe it or not, people can still buy products in those states, and it hasn't, you know, stopped people from, you know, buying consumer products or being able to buy furniture. So, like I said, I don't have the statutes right in front of me. This.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is a kind of a complicated issue. This is not a rhetorical question, it's a serious question. Why are there currently flame retardant materials, chemicals, in stock?
Mr. Chairman? Well, 2 points. First, the testing of the products that would be covered by the bill suggests that the majority of products no longer, the majority of manufacturers no longer using these flame retardant chemicals in many cases. So they're able to not use them because they're not providing a fire benefit, so they're still able to meet whatever standards are in place with respect to flammability. Historically, my understanding to the questioner was that originally the tobacco industry was very interested in putting focus on flame retardant chemicals as a way to reduce risk to people who were smoking in the home. But only subsequently did we realize that there was no actual fire benefit from the inclusion in these particular products, furniture, mattress, foam, children's products, and the like. So we're kind of playing catch-up to that understanding and the lack of efficacy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, at the risk of sounding like I am skeptical of the testimony and the data, I haven't seen that data. It appears to me that on one hand, products have been required to have flame retardant materials in them, and now we're telling folks that you can't have flame, even if they would like to have them in their furniture, because they think it's safer, or in their car seat. Is that what's going on here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, when it comes to fire safety, I think that it's we should probably listen to fire safety professionals. And I think, I will also point out, you know, some of the things that were brought up, for example, electronics. I don't know how electronic your curtains are, or your, you know, children's products aren't necessarily included in that. I think initially the idea was that it would be, when you don't know what any of the cons are, I think there was an error on the side of putting the chemicals in everything. And I think I would also guess that the chemical industry probably does a good job of selling their chemicals as well. So I doubt that I'm going to convince you to not be skeptical if the testimony of our firefighters and doctors is not going to convince you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that doesn't give me comfort because Representative Becker-Finn, her testimony just now, said, I think and I guess. I'd like to see the data. I'd like to see the scientific information that's available. But I'm glad that you mentioned firefighting professionals. As people know, I take these things seriously, so I got on the phone and I called the chief at the Thief River Falls Fire Department and I asked him about this bill. First of all, he knows nothing about it. Okay? And I would guess that if you folks called your chiefs in your cities, you're probably going to hear the same thing. Now, I'm not saying necessarily that we shouldn't be doing something, but what we're doing here is really asking legislators who are not firefighters, who are not scientists, to make a decision. And here's a quote from the chief in Thief River Falls with regards to the foam. He says, it's nice to know you have it when you need it. He said, I would shudder to think if it's not available. He also says it's helpful in suppressing vapors. He told me that they had a truck that turned into one of the filling stations in Thief River Falls last week, turned the corner too short, and the tanker tipped over. Luckily, it didn't start on fire. But had it started on fire, the Class B foam, he said, would have been absolutely essential. We've had conversation, Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn would yield to a question. In your amendment on line point 1.6, what's the definition of a petroleum kernel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know that I don't have that answer right in front of me.
No, I don't know that. I'm excuse me, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
go ahead. Mr. Chair, perhaps House Research has the ability to look that up. Mr. Chair, members.
Go ahead.
I do not know if there is one in statute, but I could use my phone to see if there is one. Right.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Benderkin, I honestly don't know that you don't have the definition of that, okay? Seriously. But my question is what is a petroleum terminal? Is it the small bulk tanks that are located in Badger, Minnesota at the Senex terminal? So my point there is if we're going to exempt airports and terminals, right, why wouldn't we exempt some other things? Why are we going to exempt the city of Thief River Falls that has a dozen or more trains coming through their city every day carrying oil? And heaven forbid if the train derails and something starts on fire and they don't have the best tools available to them to put that fire out to protect their citizens and their neighborhoods. And that goes on all over in my district. And it happens in Moorhead. It happens right down here by the river in St. Paul. So I'm struggling with this bill in that it seems to be a kind of a hurry up and get this done. The chief of Thief River Falls said, let me decide what is the best thing to use when we're putting out fires. And in terms of the breathing in and stuff, and again, Mr. Humphreys, I think it was, where's he at? I respect the work that you firefighters do. My neighbors are the volunteer firefighters in Roseau and around my district. But the chief in Thief River says that they wear, they completely masked and stuff when they are on the scenes and stuff, when some of the stuff is going on. So I would like some of the copies of the data that's being talked about this evening. And I think that if we're going to have these exemptions for refineries, airports, and terminals, that really needs to be expanded and we need to take a hard look at it. Even a car that starts on fire, okay, in rural Bemidji. The chief told me that the VOM works really good in rural Minnesota because when you go out, is there fire hydrants out in the country all over the place? There's not. And they have a limited amount of water that they can take with them. And this foam actually helps to reduce the amount of water that they need on the scene. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to stop for now.
Well, thank you. And I just let me say a couple words here because we heard early on, and I don't recollect from whom, but in the description of the chemicals here, and I just want to put a little gravity into this. We heard dioxinfuran. Anybody know what that means in chemistry? I'm a chemist, so I know.
I do. It's nasty.
It's Agent Orange. Uh-huh. We ain't talking about peanuts here. This is serious stuff. And most of us Vietnam vets really don't even like when we hear that and the public's being exposed to it. I got a son that's a firefighter in Cass Lake, and they're talking about this. If you talk to your fire chief, they're talking about it, even with their masks. Do they get sick? You betcha. Yep, they've been in a tough fire. So anyway, this isn't being done in any kind of a loose fashion, is all I want to say. Yes.
And Mr. Chair, you know that I mean no disrespect to anyone when I'm talking
absolutely
about
this. Absolutely, Representative Fabian. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of things. This isn't something that we're rushing through. This is something that was carried last biennium by Representative Howe, if members will remember, and now a GOP senator, then representative, and unfortunately, we weren't able to have a public discussion about this issue in the last biennium because it never got scheduled for a hearing. So it isn't a new thing that's being rushed. It's the urgency is that if we don't do it, our firefighters are being harmed, and you know potentially kids are being harmed, and you know, this is committee stop number three, And I do appreciate the folks from St. Paul Park who did come talk to me in between hearings, and we, you know, they brought their concerns. I'm, you know, this isn't trying to ram something through without being thoughtful about it. That's why we made, that's why we have the amendment. And I don't think to try to spin it into some kind of rural urban thing, I think is somewhat misleading when the Minnesota Professional Firefighters represent folks from all over the state. Mm-hmm. I will also say, and I know I'm the only one maybe besides Mr. Quillis that's been at every hearing, but we did in a discussion and some questions in the Commerce Committee, the question was asked about the firefighting foam, and apparently many fire departments use a different class of foam, and so it isn't necessarily going, actually it was Representative Listelgard who asked that question related to his fire departments in his district. So there are options. It's just, do we want to make the step of addressing this now or waiting for the feds to do something? And I don't know about the rest of you, but I don't have much faith in waiting for the feds to do anything, you know, kind of regardless of the level that we're dealing with. So, I mean, at the end of the day, I know who I'm going to trust regarding fire safety, and that's going to be the professionals who put their lives on the line, and it's their life is all about fire safety and protecting the people in our communities.
Mr. William.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to add that I'm always very careful speaking in these settings to reference my comments, and I did earlier, it wasn't within the time allotment, but I did forward the references for my comments to the committee administrator, and I'm sure he'd be happy to share those with anybody who would like to dig into the details.
Does in literature?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Science literature. Okay. Very good. Real quick, I've got to thank you, Representative Payton.
Just two things real quickly, and I'm disappointed that Representative Becker-Finn chose to use the word spin and rural versus metro. That isn't what this is about at all. And she mentioned Representative Howe's bill. How is this bill different from Representative Howe's bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Howe is carrying it right now in the Senate. He's the Senate author of this exact bill in the Senate, minus the amendment that we just made.
Okay, I have Representative Blue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the areas I'm going to be concerned about here is we named off several facilities and entities that will be allowed to continue using AFFF, or we call it mechanical foam in our day. But does that include any of the maritime-related firefighting that we may be responsible to do here in Minnesota? We do have a significant water traffic at both ends of the state, and there's some very specific uses. I date myself a little bit, but one of the immediate emergency actions, if you had a issue in an engine room, was even as minor as a leak, was be deferring that petroleum product before you killed everybody with mechanical foam. Now, I do know that the Air Force and I suspect the DOD in general is trying to move to a less hazardous type of foam. I'm not sure they're all done with that. I think the Air Force may be a little bit ahead of the rest of them. I got a real concern here whether the author, do we legitimately know all the places out there, all the fire departments that right now are using the mechanical foam that we're talking about banning? Because, you know, you don't get the pit where the petroleum fire is. Basically, we call them Class Bravo fires. They go where the material that will combust, and it goes on trucks, it goes on rail cars, and all kinds of other places. Plus, you can also have a spill and a pipeline that's transporting crude, and it would sure be a shame. Light or heavy water is not going to work in that environment unless you happen to be sitting right beside a water tower. So I mean, do we really understand? Can somebody unequivocally explain how much of that stuff is out there, who's using it right now, and who, in less than 18 months, won't be able to buy it?
Reverend Baker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we do have one more committee stop, and I would be happy to work with you and others to make sure that we are doing this in the safest way. And that, I mean, that's the whole reason we have committee process and why this takes so long, is so that there's time to have those discussions and make sure that we're addressing those concerns. So I'm happy to work with folks to, if there's something else that needs to be added along the lines of what we did in the amendment that we passed here today, I'm happy to do that.
I guess that's true. Can I ask, what committee stop are we talking about, this next one?
We know Ways and Means for sure.
Okay, well, that's great. We love the money people, Mr. Chair, fooling with firefighting stuff. My concern here, and what I would suggest, is you've got a portion of this. I think slamming a hammer down here in 18 months or less over the use of mechanical foam where it can be used and basically shutting the spigot off to folks, that's the part of the bill I really got some issues with here, because I don't think another stop is going to produce the kind of information in front of the right people to begin with on what we should be doing with this. And, you know, we talked to the folks up at Duluth. I mean, they got ocean-going vessels in there every day of the week when the ice isn't out. And unless things have radically, radically changed, that is an important element for afloat stuff, whether it's an engine room or whether you're an oil tanker. So I would just like to see us amend that portion out and spend 18 months really figuring out exactly who you're going to impact, because then if we can't procure it, but, you know, in some cases we might have to change the type of equipment that a fire department has. Hopefully there's going to be a one-for-one. You can replace that stuff with something that is much, much less toxic. But I just don't see that yet. I mean, we're playing with huge element of public safety here, and I don't think it's worth the risk. I don't think we can wait on that portion of the bill, Mr. Chair. That's what I would suggest to the author. Not one more stop. One more stop doesn't buy it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure where the 18 months number is coming from, but it's my understanding, actually, there's a PCA enforcement issue, so the other stop is likely going to be environment finance, which you yourself will have ample opportunity to weigh in there. You know, we're not going to fix the bill in the next 5 minutes to your liking. But I, as I said, I'm happy to work with Mr. Quillis and anyone else who's interested in making the bill better, if that's what we feel like we need to do to make it safe.
Mr. Chair, if I could, what I would suggest, rather than moving along, I would suggest and I would move that we just lay the bill on the table and let's bring that testimony right here. It's some time in the near future, rather than keep bouncing around from committee to committee. It's the policy committee, and we're talking about some major policy decisions here relative to everybody that's in the firefighting business in the state of Minnesota. So I would make that move and ask the roll call if that's appropriate, Mr. Chair, that motion.
No, okay. I'm not hearing to the contrary procedurally, so. I'll ask for you're asking to lay the bill on the table.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair, and I want to make it clear to the point where we can rehear this with an absolute understanding of who is impacted throughout the state of Minnesota. And if that takes a few days to get the right people here that can speak to that, not talking about just burying it, but we need to really have this out before we move it on the committee. So I don't, you know, that laying it on the table, laying there forever, that's you and I voted. That's not what we're talking about, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Baker-Finney.
And I will just say, Mr. Chair and Representative Lewick, we all know it's deadline week. If we don't move on this bill, then we aren't going to be able to give these protections to firefighters. And so I would encourage folks to vote no on the motion.
And I'm just going to, it's a non-debatable motion, and so the clerk will take the vote. Chair votes no.
Becker Finn?
No.
Lewick?
Yes.
Acom? Anderson?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Claflin?
No.
Fabian?
Yes.
Gomez?
No.
Green?
Yes.
Hansen?
No.
Heintzman?
Yes.
Lippert?
No.
Wislegard?
No.
Wiginius?
Seven to six. The motion does not prevail. We will proceed, and I do have one more on the list here. For question, President Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had two things. One, I heard some discussion wondering what internal electrical components might be involved with, like drapes and other sort of things. And one that comes to mind for me would be beds, and I hate to use a brand name, so we'll say when I use my snooze number bed at home at night, you know, that's going to have electrical devices inside of that mattress, and if there's a short that occurs in there, that's going to be a fire condition. So that's one that comes to mind. Recliner beds, electric blankets, all that sort of stuff. So that certainly would be involved with mattress and blankets and foam, and, yeah, lift chairs, all that sort of stuff. So I thought it would just, you know, bring that forward for consideration as part of the answer to the inquiry that was occurring as to what kind of electrical devices we might be looking at. Secondly, I know Representative Fabian mentioned a little bit about trains coming through your communities, and I, as a chemist, I know Bakken crude is very volatile, much more volatile than most crude oils, and we've got trains of Bakken crude running through a lot of communities throughout Minnesota, so that's a concern, and then trying to be helpful, I thought I would wonder if Representative Becker Finn might consider a friendly amendment that would fast-track Line 3, and then we wouldn't have to worry about all those trains going through all these towns with fucking crude.
I like that.
Just to lighten the moment.
Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, that's not an issue that I think is going to lighten any moment for some of us. So
that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
We need all the levity we can get.
Absolutely.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Melquist, if he would come down. And before he comes, I did hear in there that in some of the testimony that pulling some of these chemicals out might make it hard for manufacturers to meet our standards for fire retardants. So I'd like to get some clarification on that. But my question for Mr. Melquist.
Please. I'll do the best I can to answer it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then you had in your statement, in your testimony, you had said something about the chemicals only would add like 3 seconds to that fire. And I'll give you just a short story. Years ago, my sister lived in a trailer house, and she was home alone with her newborn baby, and she smelled smoke, and that fast she grabbed that baby and headed out the door. And by the time she got to her end of her driveway, which was about 5 seconds, and turned around, all that was left standing was the studs of that trailer house. The roof had collapsed, and the rest was in flames and melting. Is there a time that you can think where that 3 seconds might mean someone's life?
Mr. Chair, that's tough to say. I mean, the reason these flame retardants are put into use is to give more time. And all the studies that have been done by NIOSH, the Fire Science Journal, showing that if they are flame retardants, give us more time, you think it'd be more than 3 seconds. So that's why it's not giving us enough the cancer risk or the chemical risk that the firefighters are exposed to when they're in there fighting the fire, and after the fire is over, it's absorbed through your skin. It's not just breathing in. We've taken safety measures in the last 20 years to protect ourselves long after the fire is over, yet since the mid-1990s, our cancer rates are through the roof. And the biggest thing that's changed is the use of flame retardants. So yes, what 3 seconds may or may not give someone in that scenario an extra second to get out of the house, that may be true. I believe that if she smelled smoke, I would hope that she would have got out of the house with or without the flame retardants there, and then we wouldn't have to look at the flame retardants absorbing through our skin for the next 2 weeks. I can tell you I take saunas. I'll be in a dwelling fire tonight. I'll take saunas for the next week. While I'm sitting in that sauna, I can smell the smoke seeping out of my skin.
Mr. Chair, I'm not here to badger you, because I agree that if there's chemicals there, what I'm saying is if we have standards that have to be met, and if this is what they've come up with to meet these standards, I would disagree with you on the fact that, you know, if it's 3 seconds to get someone out of a burning home, I mean, isn't that what we all want? Isn't that what you fight for, is to get those people out? And so if there's a safer way to do it, I'm all for that. But I think we need to be careful in just saying we're going to blanket these out, especially if we're, on one hand, telling the manufacturers, you need to do these things because we demand a certain standard, and then to say, now we're going to outlaw what you've done to meet the standard, and now you won't meet the standard. So there's a lot of issues here. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I agree with them. I agree with that. Any more time we can get is beneficial. At the same time, I hope that the state of Minnesota be proactive in coming up with better chemicals or safer chemicals. I'll say it gives us the 3 seconds and isn't causing the cancer rates to go through the roof for firefighters. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've got all the members' questions. All the testifiers from the audience. Okay, so we can do or renew your motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion.
I have comments if you want. I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's all right, Mr. Chair. I think we've had enough comments on this bill. So I would renew my motion for House Bill 359 as amended to be referred to Ways and Means.
We've heard the motion. All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion passes. The bill goes to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Beckerfin. And you don't get to go very far, so.
Yeah, so he can come
in. No, we have House File 2253. And please move your bill.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 2253 be referred to the General Register. Representative Fabian is a co-author on this one, and it's, I think, if not exactly the same, very similar to a policy bill that didn't quite become law last year.
Chair almost tipped over here. Close the show, huh?
So, Mr. Chair, I do have Assistant Commissioner Meyer is here, I believe. Yes. to walk us through the bill again, these are not new provisions. It's trying to catch us up on some things that didn't get done last year.
That's true. Very good. Welcome,
Mr. Chairman, members of the record. Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of National Services. I believe you should have a fact sheet possibly for your packet as well. And ask the office that these are elements of a bill last year that were all non-controversial, worked through with all the stakeholders, and unfortunately never made it to final passage. So with that, I'm going to kind of work off of the fact sheet as well. We'll have other staff here to answer questions. Section 1 just clarifies, Section 1 amends 84775 to remove all terrain vehicle prohibitions on use of snorkel devices. Many of these devices come from the factory with this equipment on them right now. The language was instilled years ago when we were having a lot of issues with ATVs and wetlands, which has been removed now. I think the ATV riding situation, thanks to the stakeholders and the legislature, is in a completely different situation than it was when the language was passed. Section 2 changes 8486, dealing with snowmobile instructors, and allows them to charge. You'll see the language on page 3.15 to 3.16, a fee paid to the instructor for the person's online training course, trying to just streamline the way the fees are issued and collected in that section. Section 3 of the bill creates a voluntary all-terrain online training program for ages 6 to 10. It doesn't change the ability to ride or anything. It just gives youth the opportunity to take an online program to instill the training that they need to ride when they're older and hopefully correct their appearance if they're riding against the ball with them. Section 4 amends 8492.56 when a person is required to take safety training on those programs. They can learn from 6 to 10 years on that. And then Section 5 again relates to the prohibition on the snorkels with the ATVs. Section 6 allows it continues a procedure that we have had a sunset on, allowing cat fishermen to use cast nets on border waters to harvest gizzard shad when they're fishing on those waters. So if you're a flathead cat fisherman, the preferred bait of choice are gizzard shad, which don't survive very long once you take them out of the water, so you can't buy them at a bait store. This language just puts in practice permanently what we had allowed to for a short period of time so these fishermen can have a net. They still need to be tagged and operate under invasive species laws when people are using nets. So that's something that flathead cat fishermen would like to see enacted again. The next section, it relates to netting as well, or restrictions on AIS waters. Currently, if you're a bait fisherman or a bait harvester and you have a set of nets in infested waters, you have to have them tagged. This language will allow you to remove that tag once your nets have been decontaminated and inspected by DNR. So it creates the person, without this language, you have to have multiple sets of nets. One set of nets for one water body, and you can't ever take a net from an infested water to a clean body of water, an uninfested water. This will allow a person, you'll see the lines on 9.6 to 9.8, where it says, according to a protocol specified by the commissioner, if the use of decontaminated gear in other water bodies does not impose an unreasonable risk of harm. Allows us a process to help these harvesters kind of operate a little bit more effectively and cost effectively, not having to have multiple sets of nets. Section 8 relates to a study that is ongoing, and actually it sunsets this December, trying to determine how can we deal with movement of water-related equipment, boat lifts, things like that, docks, from infested waters without having to have them decontaminated if they're going right back into that water body. Current law allows a person to remove this equipment onto your shore, onto your riparian property. For example, if you live on the shore of ABC Lake and it has zebra mussels on it, you can take your dock, roll it up on your property, and then roll it back into the lake without being moved. There's people who have riparian property lakes that they don't have that ability, and we're trying to figure out a way to keep the chain of custody on that equipment to ensure it's going right back to the same spot, but not having to be decontaminated. So you'll see sections 8 and section 9 refer to that same study there. Section 10 is a technical correction that we've worked through. There was language that was developed several years ago in Chapter 299N dealing with firefighters and training structural firefighters. We want to just clarify that our wildfire fighters do not fall under that Chapter 299N requirement. These folks are red-carded. They're trained extensively through other means. The firefighting that they do is completely different than anything that would be done in a structure or anything under Chapter 299N. And the fire chiefs support that language as well. Section 11 just allows us to, you can see the language of strike on 10.29, where by law right now we're required to print one copy for each person obtaining a fishing, hunting license, or a trapping license. So, for example, we would have to print 500,000 fishing regulation books. This will allow us to right-size our printing, reduce the cost, and reduce the waste at the end of the year. Section 12, and there's a couple other sections here. Section 12 deals with elk licenses. What we're trying to do is increase the acceptance of the wild elk herd in northwestern Minnesota. There are some concerns with people that the herd is too large and it needs to be reduced and it's causing crop damage. What this allows to do, if you're a landowner, you're eligible for a tag. You'll see that on lines 1.7 or 1.8. We have a separate selection for up to 20% of the elk licenses for landowners. This would allow that landowner to transfer that license to someone else, to sell it at what the license costs. Obviously, they may have a contractual obligation with that landowner to hunt on their land outside of that license fee, but that's between the landowner and the hunter. But hopefully you can see, so the new language may sell their license to any Minnesota resident eligible to hunt big game for no more than the original cost. What we're trying to do is gain more acceptance up there to have these landowners understand that there is a economic value to the elk herd as well, and to just move some of the resistance that we're having along and continue those discussions there. Section 13 amends the elk license. We don't have a separate lottery like we have on many licenses, so if a person is unsuccessful, the first, though, again, we have the same 20% licenses. And if you're eligible, if you apply at least 10 times for an elk license and have never received the license, you are eligible to get into this second pool again. So a person who's unsuccessful in the separate selection under the subdivision would go back into the lottery for the overall lottery. So if you're successful enough to apply for 10 years for an elk license and you're not drawn, you could go back into the lottery for the overall drawing as well. Section 15 is something that we've worked out with the committee last year to allow a person with a permanent physical or a permanent physical disability to receive a firearm safety certificate, a general firearm safety certificate, which wouldn't allow them to hunt alone, but would allow that person to have a firearm safety certificate and hunt with a partner or a spouse or whoever that would be, someone that would be there with them that had a firearm safety certificate as well. Section 15 of the bill defines a handheld light for the purposes of this chapter. So there's language in state law that says you can't cast rays of light to take certain animals or to shine deer and things like that. What we're trying to do under this section, you'll see on the top of page 13, is define a handheld light, which means an artificial light that is carried in the hand or attached to a person. Clarification language. The next section, 16, again, defines what that permanent physical disability is for that provisional firearm safety certificate that we had spoke of. This had gone through all the committees. I haven't heard of any concern with the language there. So we're defining on page or line 13.14 to 13.16 what a permanent physical disability is, and then talking about moving those forward. Mr. Chairman, and then the last page, the last section is just some more technical language talking about that gizzard shad for the bait. You can see that they certain requirements make the monofilament not exceed 5 feet in radius, certain mesh requirements, and then they can only use them for certain periods of time. And that is the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Then, if I may, I've got a question. The wood kit has a question. What is a snorkel on an ATV? I'm an old mechanic, so I think I know, but I've never heard of it before.
Mr. Chairman, members, it's different on each machine. Basically, what it is, it allows, if you think of a muffler on the back of an ATV, if it cases it, it keeps that up a little bit higher. So in some cases, that's what we had seen in the past in this language, came to fruition back over 10 years ago. People would paint a big, think of it as a pipe that came from the muffler and went up above. So if you stop, if your machine is completely underwater, which is against the law, you would still be able to operate.
Is that an amendment for exhibition? And I would have thought it was an intake as opposed to exhaust.
It's the same thing with vice, but not on the
motor. Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, the snorkel, I remember Googling this last year, and it's not as cool as it sounds like it might be, but...
So what's in the bill? That's pretty special. Okay. Any other comments for Jim Beckerfin? The bill itself. I mean, I'm not. We got. I don't know how many anybody's name written down here, but okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Commissioner Meyer, I'm glad that you recognize the responsible ATV riders out there. And I continue to be frustrated that the law has been told for over a year that you're going to get together with the people up at Hughes Lake State Park, and that hasn't happened yet. The chair told me he's talked to you a couple of times about this issue and want to find a solution. And quite frankly, folks up there are pretty upset with the DNR. And I think it's incumbent upon you and your agency to follow through on your word.
Mr. Chairman, just really quickly represent that.
Please.
We're in the process of having a meeting scheduled with the Commissioner and the DNR up in Roosevelt County. We'll let you know when that happens. And also trying to get a plan forward for the Hayes Lake public participation process that we're talking
about. Mr. Chair, if I may, thank you. That meeting was scheduled. It's not been changed to May. This is deadline week. And this was something that was really important to the sorry, Mr. Chair, but the ball has been badly dropped. And I've tried to play with the system and work through these things and do things the way we like to do them around here, but the folks up there are not being respected.
I'm going to keep my good thoughts and let's take it forward. Other questions, members?
Good to manage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, just a clarification on Section 12, when you talked about a landowner being able to get a license and then sell it, and you talked about kind of an economic benefit, and you can't sell it for more than the original cost of the license, so I don't quite understand the economic benefit if you buy it for whatever and sell it for the same price. Is that be my correct in understanding that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, this license is only good on those lands that owner has. So, as I said, the value of the license cannot be increased, but there would need to be some kind of arrangement for that person to be allowed to hunt on that person's property. And that arrangement is between that landowner and the person who buys that license. I mean, what we're seeing is we have world-class elk up there, elk that are bigger than any other places in the country. For certain populations, and we think there would be value in people wanting to go up there.
Questions? Anybody from the audience looking to justify on this bill?
Sorry.
Somebody's running up here. No, President Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad the gizzard shad lobbyists aren't here tonight. We'll renew my motion that House File 2253 be referred to the General Register.
Got the motion before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The bill is on its way. Thank you. Jim Sansley, House File 1880, Government School Fund Compensation Authority clarified, and for our conversation, there's some clarification that you would like to bring to this, so please proceed with Jim Sansley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before you have House File 1880, and in your packet, you should also have an amendment We are not going to act on the amendment tonight, but I am going to discuss it. My understanding is this bill is moving on to environment finance, and the amendment will be adopted at that committee stop. But discussing the amendment will give you a little bit of context of the purpose of this bill.
If I may.
You may.
We do not have the amendment. It's coming. Okay, just as you're speaking to it, so folks do have it.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, House File 1880, do we need to move this bill?
Let's do that, yes. And I will move that House File 1880 be referred to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1880 is a bill that deals strictly with the DNR's compensation authority to the Permanent School Trust Fund, or the Permanent School Fund. This bill clarifies, streamlines, and consolidates the compensation language under one umbrella into statute, and it also provides the DNR a new tool by allowing them to use lease payments as a compensation mechanism. By way of background, school trust lands granted to the state by the federal government in 1858 were set aside to provide a continual source of funding for public education and are managed in a way that generates revenue for the Permanent School Fund. Interest and dividends from the fund are distributed to every public school district within the state. The DNR is the trustee of the school trust lands, and they have a fiduciary responsibility to manage the lands to maximize the returns. The two statutes, 92.121 and 84.027, subdivision 18D, that house the current compensation language, contain inconsistency in terms of how and when the DNR should compensate the trust. House File 1880 removes the inconsistencies by clarifying the administration, when and how to compensate the fund. It also gives the DNR flexibility, as I alluded to before, by expanding their explicit authority to enter into leases instead of compensating the trust from only condemnation or exchange of lands, and provides consistency by simplifying the requirements to compensate the trust by applying the requirement broadly across all 2.5 million acres of school trust lands instead of just specific school trust lands. This bill is supported by the Office of School Trust Lands as well as the DNR. I'm hopeful that the changes made within the bill will, over time, increase revenue for the Permanent School Fund, and following that, strengthen education opportunities for our Minnesota students. We did have a committee hearing yesterday in the Senate, or in the Senate office building, and we took no action on this, but we just basically discussed the bill. There was no opposition at that point in time, and that's just for clarity. With me, I have DNR Commissioner Bob Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members,
Edna Meyer.
I think for the sake of the committee, what I'd like to do is walk through the bill really quickly with the amendment. If that's okay, or we'll need to amend it at the next. So
it's okay by me. Just so members know what the bill is going to look like.
So, Mr. Chairman, members, as Representative Sansi said, this bill really clarifies and it provides additional tools for the DNR to compensate trust, protect the conservation values on these trust lands, and also meet the fiduciary responsibilities. Section 1 of the bill contains some technical, mostly technical things. 1.8 changing for the administration of to administer. Then you will see on the next page, as we're seeing in many bills, changing shalls to musts, something the revisor is trying to codify in any statute that you can come across. And then 2.29, we're clarifying language that used to say when future designations or policies, we're changing that to when management practices, policies, or designations by the commissioner diminish or prohibit the long-term return on school trust land, the conflict must be resolved by language that says provided in section 91.121. The amendment now that is before you that's not being offered tonight but will be offered at the next stop, I will move to that. it changes 92.121 to actually 92.122, and then we delete 92.121, if I'm not confusing people completely. So we're changing, basically the language that's in the bill is going to be changed to compensating permanent school fund rather than permanent school fund lands that's currently in the bill. And it talks about compensation requirements. Again, when revenue generated by school trust land and associated resources is diminished by management practices applied to the land and resources, as determined by the commissioner must compensate the school permanent school fund. And then when that's going to be diminished by a policy or designation applied to the land and resources as determined by the commissioner, we must compensate before that designation is applied. So since we have to compensate, and it has to be done before that would be applied, such as protecting a cedar deer yard in the middle of a piece of school trust fund land as habitat. So we would be providing a payment to the trust for that management practice that we're deferring, that would be the ability to raise revenue. Then it gets more clear. Here's where we provide the additional tools, compensation methods. It allows us to exchange compensation methods include on 1.14, exchanging other land that's compatible with the goal of school trust fund land in the Constitution. 1.7 to 1.8, leasing and with rental payments as compensation or condemnation. The current statute that there came about in 2012 when the original thought was to buy or exchange. In conversations and working through the management methods that DNR is developing with the Office of School Trust Lands, one of the preferred options is to provide a lease payment. For the example, on the cedar yards, you don't need the land underneath it. What we want to preserve is that timber or that cedar yard to provide that deer habitat. Those cedar yards aren't going to be around forever, so we would provide a lease payment until that cedar yard pretty much is harvested or no longer there in the area.
Jim Green.
I can wait till they're done.
So, go ahead.
Okay.
No, Mr. Chair, I'm just waiting for done. I was only raising my hand again.
All right, then. Just keep notes on how many you got.
The next section of the amendment talks about this in terms for compensation funds. So with advice of the school trust lands director, the commissioner may lease school trust lands, compensate the school permanent school fund, and then rental payments under that subdivision. This is really important to understand. The money will go into the forest expense account as non-qualifying revenue, which means the DNR cannot certify management costs against that revenue. And then the next line actually says that, not subject to cost certification. Must be paid in full upon executing the lease, and then as determined by the commissioner, subject to review by a licensed appraiser, that would be an independent appraisal. Those funds are in that account. They go to another suspense account, and then MMB sweeps that other suspense account quarterly. So there's interest being earned at each one of those steps. It's just easier to do it that way than trying to deposit immediately into the permanent school. And we had a discussion, as the author said, within the permanent school fund commission yesterday, and there were no questions on that. After that, that's the rest of the bill. So that the amendment deals with section 2, and then we go back to section 3, talking about the compensation that was there, that was in the amendment as well. If I did not confuse everybody completely, that's the bill. So as we talked about, this language was drafted in consultation with the director of the Office of School Trust Lands. And though they did not take a vote affirming the support of it, the Permanent School Fund Commission did discuss it, and there were no questions.
Okay, good. And members, I'm just going to repeat this. It was my decision to have this amendment did not make deadline, but I wanted you all to hear what the bill is going to look like. We do expect this to go on. So, okay. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, as usual, mine is more of a comment than a question. And everything is Sandstead. Thanks for picking up this bill, I guess. But it, for me, it's kind of like a big loss because, we talk about the DNR managing and the DNR is going to make payments to the school trust and the DNR is going to have lease and rental agreements. But the DNR is working off taxpayer funds. And so once again, we're using taxpayer money to reimburse taxpayers' money. And it's just a clouded issue. And for a long time, you know, we've had the school trust land, and the whole idea behind it was to harvest the resources off it, whether it be timber and let it regrow again, or get the minerals off of it, or whatever the case may be on this land. And it's permanent trust land, and so if we sell it or exchange it, I don't like that, because nothing is going to hold its value the way land does. And once it's gone, it's gone. And so instead of mandating, which we've been trying to do for years before you got here, mandating that we harvest these resources so that they can regenerate and harvest them again, we're giving up. And we already have a lot of old growth forest, which is giving us a lot of trouble anyway. A lot of the wildlife that we have needs new growth. And so we should be taking these lands and using them the way they were meant to be used and putting that money in. I don't have the exact figures in front of me, and so if I'm wrong, you can correct me later, but I believe there's, close to $7 billion worth of resources on these lands, which when you take off the, you know, what it takes to harvest them, it probably gets down to maybe $1 billion, $1.5 billion to the schools, or you know, maybe more, maybe less, but that's still a lot of money for our schools. And so it just doesn't make sense to me to be making payments with taxpayer dollars to recoup, you know, to compensate taxpayers. So I, you know, appreciate you being willing to carry a bill, but I really don't like the bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Green, I would be happy to work with you if you see a path forward on this, but the school trust lands and the fund are in existence, and my obligation is to make sure that that is kept whole. So if there's something that I can do to work with you moving forward, I'm happy to do that.
Thank you for that. Representative Logan.
Mr. Chair, respectfully disagree a little bit with Representative Green on what we're doing here, and this is a hard concept to really get in front of you, so it's not as simple as it sounds, but what we're basically doing here, we're trying to correct about a century of unintentional trespass and simply taking possession of land that did not belong to the general public. Let me say that again. This land never belonged to the general public. It was set aside very specifically to pay for our K-12, at that time it was 112, education. It was set aside, most of it was set aside before we were even a state. Now, this is a cross that leadership and the DNR has to bear today. But literally for a century, we looked at it as simply public land. So anybody can use it for anything they want. So, as opposed to what it was set aside for, very specifically to generate revenue, to pay for the district, for our current public education system. So what's happened here is we've got encroachments, things like public accesses. They've got a big DNR sign on them, and they've been there for 50, 80, who knows, even before they put a sign on it. Well, that's land that borders a lake, so it's public land, so let's put an access there. Well, guess what? That access is still there. It still belongs to the school trust, not to the general public, and we're generating zero revenue off of it. And just as recently as, over the last decade, we've ran trails across, from all kinds of trails, across school trust land with no compensation. So here again, the general public is merely trespassing. It sounds silly, but it's that simple. We've opened these lands up to uses that can, in some cases, hinder or really complicate generating revenue. I know we've been in some skirmishes over you can't harvest that timber because that's
I'll see it from my ski trail. You know, and I can appreciate that. I understand where the folks are coming from, but do we understand that that property was never intended to be your ski trail? It was there to generate revenue for our education system. We made real progress here, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but we were able to punch out $25 per student on an annual basis out of the trust fund. That's got up into the middle 30s per student. That didn't sound like a whole lot, but that is money that goes right to your school district. And you know who gets the biggest share of it? The metro area. You know, I'm not trying to go the metro rural business, but just look where the kids are. So who's got the most kids in one place? It happens to be here in the metro area. This is so what we're trying to do here is get to a situation where we're being honest about this. We've got this property sitting in the middle of the wildlife management areas. We were able to harvest timber on there. We've got it sitting in the middle of state parks where, you know what? It's not so simple to harvest timber in the middle of a state park. There isn't a piece of the park sticker that goes to the school trust hand for rent for that property. It's just... It's okay. We're going to take it from the kids. So, and my impassioned plea is, I'm a member of the Permanent School Trust Commission, as Lev Sanska is, and I've been for going my fifth year here. We're trying to write better than a century of unintentional trespass and taking possession and use of property that the general public is not entitled to without at least compensating the education system and our local school district for what we're doing. So I'll jump off my soapbox, Mr. Chair, and just thank Representative Sansley for bringing this forward, because this is a tough one to get your head around. Thank you.
Appreciate your passion, Representative Lewis. It's a good one for us to understand. And so... Any other questions, members? Anybody in the audience looking to testify for or against this bill? If not, final comments? Sorry. Representative Wiginius.
So, I'm not going to testify against this bill, but I think we would all be served well to go back and look at what the Constitution actually says about school trust lands. And if I remember correctly, the Constitution says nothing about generating income from them. What it says is if you sell the lands, then the money goes into the school trust. And then once it's in the school trust, it does have to bear interest for the school children. So I just wanted to put that on the record. I think my memory is correct, and maybe we can go over that some other time, but I just felt a need to put that on the record.
Thanks.
Thank you. And I think we're ready now. Do you have some closing comments, Representative?
Thank you for your support.
It's a simple bill. Thank you. And so, we got to renew our motion here. I'll renew my motion now. House File 1880 be referred to Ways and Means.
Motion.
Before us, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. No. Thank you.
Bill passed. Motion passed. Thank you.
Greetings. Apparently, we have House File 1584. And please, would you tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you move the bill before the
committee? I'm sorry, I'll do that. Let me look. Okay. I will move that House File 1584 be referred to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is a bill from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to change the
eligibility requirements of their small business environmental loan improvement program. And as members of the committee may know, this was passed last year, but we're not signed to the law, and so that's why we're here today. And this bill will expand the availability to businesses with less than 100 employees, eliminates the 100, the, I'm sorry, the $1 million cap on a business net worth, lower the interest rate on loans, and raise the allowable amount from $50,000 to $75,000. And staff from the PCA is here to answer any technical questions that I may not be today.
Okay, we're good. And I'll just ask for questions just to start things out. Members, what you've heard so far?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is a good bill. Thanks for bringing it forward and it helps some businesses have access here, so thank you.
Is anyone out there in the audience? Our audience is significantly diminished, so for this bill, wanting to testify on this bill. Do you want to have some comments on this? That's fine. Please introduce yourself for the record and give us your comment.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Alexis Stone from the MPCA. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 1584, and thank you to Representative Lee for carrying the bill. Representative Lee summarized most of the points that we had to make about the bill. I think the important thing is that it opens up this program to more businesses, and it updates conditions that have not been updated since this program was created in 1997. Some of the financial realities that businesses are facing have changed since 1997. For example, we're expanding the loan cap from $50,000 to $75,000 in recognition of the reality of the cost of the projects that businesses are undertaking today, and also just changing the interest terms to provide more flexibility in conditions when the prime interest rates are low. Currently, the prime interest rate is 5.25%. In the early 90s, the prime rate hovered in the 10% range, and in March of 1997, when this program was created, it was 8.5%. And so Representative Lee's bill just creates the option of offering an attractive interest rate in low interest rate conditions. Thank you for your time, and I am happy to stand for questions.
I'll renew my offer to entertain questions one more time. Any further testimony from the audience? If not, I'm going to pass by my comments and agree with Representative Anderson. I think we've got a good bill here, Representative Lee, and any closing comments?
I just want to say thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for hearing this bill and I'm asking for your support. Thank you.
And I'll redo my motion that House File 1584 be referred to Ways and Means. A motion before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Hensley. And Representative Sandell, welcome to House File 1886. Please tell us about the bill, if you will. I'm sorry, let me say, I get to hearing about good bills. And anyway, I'll move the House File 1886 be sent to the General Register.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the invitation to be here tonight and talk to the committee about House File 1886 and the issue of silica sand mining. In Minnesota, 19 counties have near-surface silica sand resources. The quality of sand is perhaps the best in the world, and the industrial demand for the product makes it a profitable commodity. Minnesota has delegated the authority to permit these resources to local governments. House File 1886 is a response to earlier legislation passed in 2013 gave the Department of Natural Resources authority to write rules pertaining to the reclamation of silica sand mines. but without any authority to administer or enforce those rules. That left the counties with some legal and financial vulnerability. House File 1886 directs the Department of Natural Resources to develop a model ordinance pertaining to silica sand reclamation and to publish it in the State Register, giving support to those counties that need it. Heather Ahrens is here with me today representing the DNR and can better describe the importance and the implications of this legislation. Ms. Ahrens.
You can introduce yourself to the record and proceed.
Thank you, Representatives. Mr. Chair, my name is Heather Ahrens. I'm with the Department of Natural Resources. I was the technical lead for the silica sand reclamation rule. I'd like to begin by saying that the process of developing the provisions of the rule was very inclusive of diverse input of different stakeholders. We held a year-long advisory committee that involved representatives from LGUs, representatives from citizen interests, and representatives from industry interests. And in the process of developing the rule, it was, we gained consensus amongst dispersed user groups, specifically between the with environmental interests as well as industry interests. As we moved from developing what those provisions look like into considering what the administration of the rule would look like, we got increasing concerns that it would put counties into legal and financial difficulties in terms of how they would administer the rule. Let me first off begin by the definition of a rule in statute, and so statute 14.02 is for an agency to clarify its existing statutes or clarify its existing organizational structure. Because the DNR does not oversee silica sand permitting, that is under local authority, we're essentially writing rules to be administered by local authorities that the DNR has no way to enforce that this would be administered, statewide in an equal fashion, and it has no way to make sure that that counties are adopting this into ordinance. We can't say that counties have to adopt this by ordinance. As a result, counties can either adopt it by full or partial, so there would be no statewide provisions. And if a county decided, and there are some counties after 2012 that just went in and invested time and energy into developing their own mining ordinances for silica sand and as well as other ordinances to regulate silica sand, that they're already addressed some of the issues that they had some initial concerns with. So our concern is that if a county didn't adopt these rules into their ordinance, that they would be subject to lawsuits, and that would be the only way to administer that if there was a disagreement about the rule, the DNR wouldn't be able to say, no, counties, you need to do this. That it would only be decided in the judicial system. So, in acknowledging the work that people put into this, and like I said, it's something that we're very proud of, that we feel that it would be best moved into a model ordinance published in the Register to make it available so that people can use it and that people can modify it to meet their needs without any legal jeopardy. And then also for counties that have developed ordinances that they feel are robust and that they feel are good, that this doesn't compromise their initiatives, that this doesn't undermine some of the public processes that they went through, that they're not in legal jeopardy of not following state rules. And so we would like to move this forward, this provision, to change our authority from developing rules to developing model standards.
Sounds interesting. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that, because I was wondering what the difference between model ordinance and the rule is. Now, if you develop the ordinance, then what mandates are the counties under to adopt that ordinance?
There would be no mandate to adopt the ordinance, but if a county felt like they needed it, they would have a model ordinance that has been technically vetted
through state experts on financial assurance and reclamation standards so that they can adopt it fully. If a county feels that their ordinance are, you know, is robust, or that they, you know, don't want to have silica sand mine, you know, that wherever they fall, and there's a wide range of ways that counties have administered silica sand. For example, LeSueur County has been mining silica sand in LeSueur County for 40, 50, 60 years. It used to be the largest frack sand mine in the U.S. until the 2012. And so their comment is, well, we have this under control and have for a while, and we're fine. And then I know that Goodhue County has, like I said, worked with their citizens groups to develop other ordinances and zoning to look at silica sand. And so, so it would be completely voluntary. So, long story short, it'd be completely voluntary.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer here. That sounds good to me. One question. Did the counties ask for this then?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In feedback that we've gotten from different counties, there was, I think, a array, as you can imagine, of responses of what the silica sand rule, if we were to put this into rule, and the impacts that it would have on them. Some were in support, and some were, you know, that we have this under control.
Okay, we're talking the rule again. So were they in support of the rule, or are they in support of the ordinance, or do they not want the ordinance? Are the counties here?
Ms. Ahrens, I'll ask again if anybody wants to come up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the feedback, we've done several draft documents of the rule, and then went out to talk to every impacted county. And so I got direct feedback as we talked about the rule. And so in this proposal, we did not directly talk to the counties for developing into a model standard, but this is coming from the outreach that we did with the rulemaking. And so it was that feedback that helped us formulate what these concerns were, and so, like I said, it was a wide response. Some of the counties that I think initially were struggling with silica sand have resolved it on their own, and some of them, I think some of the smaller townships may want to have, and townships may want to have guidance documents to refer to.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. And I'll just add, Representative Green, that there weren't any counties that did respond to the bill being posted and all that. So I'm guessing it's not hot on anybody's radar anyway at this time. And any other comments from members?
Representative Lewis. Mr. Chair, I had a couple questions. Did I hear you correctly? You mentioned townships are developing their own zoning ordinance for this also?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. It depends on the way the county structure is. Sometimes the county is in charge of administering non-metallic mining. Sometimes they defer it to the township level.
Thank you. So when we talk about non-metallic mining, we're talking about gravel, black dirt.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, yes, we're talking about that's the way it's set up in statute for counties to administer is non-metallic reclamation. That includes gravel, dirt, silica sand, dimension stone, crushed stone.
Do we have rules in place in those areas that counties now base their ordinance on? I know at least a number of counties certainly have gravel and black dirt related ordinances in place at this point.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, they have their own ordinance to as per state statute, to administer that. The state only administers permits to mine for ferrous, non-ferrous, and peat over 40 acres.
So, that clear was, in other words, DNR has not done any rulemaking relative to statute and how it controls gravel mining. It's strictly the county's look at the statute. I guess a follow-up to that, Mr. Chair, is does the DNR look at those ordinances to any determinations of whether they may or may not actually meet the requirements of the statute?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, so there are no state provisions for any non-metallic mining, and that's delegated completely to local control through statute 394-25. That's the way it's been since 1924. What the state does provide is technical support. There's two means of getting technical support from the state. There's the Silica Sand Technical Advisory Team, STAT, which that any state, if they want help with ordinances, they can ask for that support through the EQB. And in terms of other non-metallic mining, the DNR runs an aggregate mapping program, which provides technical support for aggregate mining and aggregate-related issues.
I guess, and I'm asking these questions is I'm thinking in terms of planning and zoning ordinances, which literally every county has, and some townships, obviously cities do. And in that case, for example, if you're a rural county and you deal with wetlands, believe me, you're hooked on to Belt Loop with the Department of Natural Resources. And even if you do any modification of those ordinances, you got to make sure that not only you meet statute, but there's rules and stuff out there. But this is clearly a different circumstance, and if it would make it easier for everybody to operate, it probably makes sense. I guess it's a kind of a new situation where we have an agency maybe not interested in making rules. That's probably a good thing.
We're going to find out, I think. I want to ask again in the audience, anybody wanting to testify? Please come on up. Please identify yourself and present your testimony.
Good evening, Chair and members. I'm Brian Martinson, Environment and Natural Resources Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm also representing the Minnesota Association of Planning and Zoning Administrators. I've shared this language with the Planning and Zoning Administrators. They are comfortable with the direction that this takes us. Was concerns in the past with the direction and rulemaking approach by some, but we feel that the direction of a model ordinance maintains the flexibility and decision making at the local level while offering some direction for those that would seek that.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Thank you. Come on up, gentlemen. Can you introduce yourself for the record and proceed, please?
Mr. Chair, my name is Peter Larson. I'm here with Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. I'm representing the Minnesota Industrial Sand Council, which is a part of the Aggregate and Ready Mix Association. I was here in 2013. I don't blame Representative Hansen for not being here because we both had our fill of discussions of silica sand back in 2013. This was a provision that we worked closely with the legislature to pass. there was a lot of interest in several things at that time. There was another rule requirement that was put into place at that time for the PCA a couple years ago. The legislature changed it to say that the agency may create rules for silica sand for particulate matter. And the agency has since decided they didn't need to do that rule. They're regulating the facilities under their current regulations. We think this is a smart thing to do by the DNR. We don't see a need for a rule. We actually, back in the day, supported more DNR authority. We thought it would be a good thing for the DNR to be setting a state standard and enforcing it, but we understand that they've decided that that's not what they'd like to do. I just wanted to point out to you something that we said back then is we didn't really think a reclamation standard was needed because we didn't expect many proposals. That's turned out to be true. So you will be creating a model ordinance that will apply to maybe one or two facilities perhaps in the next 10 years. Mr. Cunningham is going to speak in more detail about this, but from the Sand Council's point of view, we like talking about reclamation. It's something that we think we do well. It's a good focus for folks to look at mining facilities and look at reclamation. We want to thank Heather for the work that she did. She worked very closely with us, was very receptive, generous with her time. And we appreciate all the work that went into what would be adopted as a model ordinance. I'm here just on behalf of the silica sand facilities to tell you that there's not much need for it from our perspective.
Thanks for your testimony. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Cunningham. I'm the relatively new executive director for the Aggregate and Ready-Mix Association of Minnesota. And I'm glad I have Peter Larson here to help me tonight because he does have most of the background on this issue, and I appreciate that. First of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity to offer some comments tonight on behalf of all of Minnesota's aggregate producers. The aggregate industry in Minnesota includes producers of both sand and rock, and so you had some discussion about that earlier with Heather, about what that includes. It basically includes gravel, crushed stone, other types of stone, and sand, and all types of sand. So although the proposed bill, HF 1886, pertains to a very specific type of sand, we felt an obligation to offer the perspective of the broader industry, the broader aggregate industry tonight. We're supportive of the work that was done by the Aggregate Resources Task Force, and Representative Look was a part of that, which was completed in January of 18. Included in the ARTF report is a recommendation to update the DNR's reclamation handbook. From our broader perspective, it's our belief that an updated reclamation handbook would best serve the needs of local agencies throughout the state, throughout the spectrum of those aggregate products that are mined throughout the state. So there is a difference. We're talking about the industrial sand is specific to this bill. We're looking at the broader spectrum of aggregates throughout the state. The current version of the Reclamation Handbook was published in 1992. It was updated in 2003. The difference between reclamation today and reclamation over 25 years ago is significantly different. And we would encourage you to put resources towards updating that reclamation handbook as a way to address things like this model ordinance or ordinances in general for reclamation. Our industry is not opposed to the proposal of model ordinance for industrial sand mining. We would simply ask that it be recognized as one of many steps that would allow reasonable and responsible use of Minnesota's aggregate resources, which are required to build and maintain the very necessary infrastructure on which our citizens and businesses rely. One last thing I would say, Peter mentioned that there have been few, if any, new facilities since 2011. It's not a type of facility that you're likely to see a lot of application for. So it is a small part of what we do in the state. Again, thank you for the opportunity to comment, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know Peter would be too.
Thanks for your testimony. Any questions for the two testifiers, one or the other?
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my first college degree was in journalism, and that was a long time ago, and job markets changed. But my news reporting professor told me, don't ever be afraid to ask a stupid question, because there's probably people out there who want to know the same thing. So I may be the only one, but as a freshman legislator, I want to ask, help me understand, what is a model ordinance?
Well, I should probably let Heather explain that, but from our perspective, a model ordinance is an example of a type of ordinance that a county might use. Am I close? Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
She just didn't want to come up. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Okay.
I agree.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. Very good. Other questions from members? Thank you for your testimony. Representative Sandell, do you have final comments about House File 1886?
I have no final comments, Representative, but it seems to me now you recognize when Representative Hansen offered this bill up, I jumped at the chance to carry it, and I enjoyed the learning curve and the evening, and so thanks very much for your attention and help.
Thank you, and thank you for carrying the bill, and I will renew my motion that House File 1886 be sent to the General Register. The motion before us, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
See you on the floor. Thank you. So we have Representative Anderson. House File 122. Please introduce yourself and tell us about the bill. Do we have amendment? No, we don't.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Chair, members, for hearing the bill. It came to me from the city of Albany, which is up in Stearns County, which is the leading dairy producing county in the state. There's a Kraft cheese processing plant kind of in the middle of town, and they would like to do a major expansion in the city. And to do what they need to acquire a narrow strip of land along the south edge of the building currently there. And that's a MnDOT rail easement. So we've met with MnDOT and the city and the Kraft folks and have come up with this this language. And this language was put in place by MnDOT. So they are in agreement with the bill, and the MnDOT folks are here, and they can talk to it too if they would care.
Representative, consistent. I'm being consistent tonight. I just forgot to move the bill. Would you want to move your bill?
I certainly like to do that, Mr. Chair. Move the bill to
going to transportation.
Very good. Thank you much. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. So House File 122 is moved to be sent to transportation. So please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs, and we were approached by the City of Albany and Kraft Heinz, we are willing to make the land available to them for the expansion, but after reviewing the rail bank statute, we realized we could not do that under existing law. There's a provision that says a rail bank has to be a minimum of 100 feet. The rail link is actually narrower than that in this spot already, and so that explains the need for the legislation. And as you'll see, there's a requirement in the bill that the company will have to pay fair market value for the parcel of land that they're acquiring.
Okay. Questions, members? This is too easy.
No.
Okay, and we don't have any audience left to come testify. You done scared them all out of here right now.
We wore them down.
Final comment, Representative
Anderson. Well, Mr. Chair, just quickly to comment, this is where they make the cheese, part of it to go into your Doritos or Cheetos and things like that we all might like to snack on, especially at this time of the day. So I do encourage the committee's support, and thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Representative Anderson renews his motion. House File 122 be passed and sent to transportation. The motion before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Let's see, we're looking for more bills here. No?
Yeah, I thought I'm
here. That was a little bit of dirty